Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Allie Irving for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. The first article is called, Cancer Taught Me the Power of Language. Poetry Helped Me Harness It. Words like biopsy and prognosis made my world feel blank. Emily Dickinson, Audre Lorde, and Andrea Gibson helped me fill the white space. This article was written by Sarah Harrington and originally published May 1st, 2026. It's cancer. I was sitting alone in a sunlit corner of my temporary Los Angeles living room, working remotely for the summer, when my doctor called. With one word, life stilled in a sudden pull of gravity. Okay, I said, unsure of how to make any other language come out of my mouth. For weeks, I'd been waiting for the results of a uterine biopsy I'd had back home in New York. Now, as the doctor began to explain the next steps, which involved specialists, surgery, and a likely hysterectomy, the dark blanket of grief fell over me. If I'd ever doubted the power of language, I felt it now, the C-word living in my own body. I took notes, wrote to-dos like genetic testing, and numbers like stage one. Endometrial cancer, I wrote in lilac ink with a borrowed pen. Only then did I feel tears. I blinked them away. We ended the call. I walked to the kitchen for water. Then it hit me. I fell to the linoleum and began to sob. It was like releasing into a wave that would either carry me to a new place or pull me under. I cried so much I burst a blood vessel in my eye. Endometrial cancer is the fourth most common cancer in women in the United States. The average age of diagnosis is 60. I was nearly two decades younger. About 68% of cases are caught early, often through unusual period-like bleeding. That's what had happened to me. I'd had some close encounters with the C-word before, but only from the outside. My mother was a breast cancer survivor. My father beat kidney cancer. I'd spent years patting my own breasts, drinking green juice, not smoking or drinking, exercising regularly, and doing everything in my power to dodge the diagnosis myself. Emptied of tears, I gathered my sneakers and drove to the beach. I walked as long as I could along the coast under the blaring Southern California sun. Questions chased me. Was this an inheritance? Chance? Had I somehow brought this my way via negative thoughts? My mind reeled over the fact of the body, its undeniable cells. I walked until my legs were sore. Exhausted, but not enough, I went to a gym. It was a Friday night and sparsely populated. I hit the chest press and began pushing metal as if I could lift the word cancer off my body. Between sets, I stared out the window at a world going on the same as it had yesterday. Families walking the shops, the neon of hotels glowing pink and blue against dusk. How could I have cancer? Or did it have me? My eyes fell on a small paper bag brown card tipped against the windowsill. Someone had handwritten a quote from Emily Dickinson. If your nerve deny you, go above your nerve. I looked around to see who might have left it, but only saw a few far-off gym bros. Emily! Poetry had saved me before, in times of loneliness and hardship. Now her words had found me just when I needed them. I pocketed the card. Her couplet would be my tether, my instruction, and my mantra for what was ahead. My doctor suggested I get a second opinion, and an oncologist at Cedars-Sinai ordered another biopsy under anesthesia. As I was wheeled into the bright light of an operating room 3,000 miles away from home, I repeated the Dickinson quote over and over. Nerve was denying me. I was terrified. But I had a poet's instructions. I didn't need to deny my fear, but I could grow larger and step over it. The results came back. It was still cancer. I began to tell people my news, and the diagnosis felt like a bomb I was throwing into conversations. Each reaction reminded me how words hook onto associations, and sometimes projections, that might not even be true to what we feel. One friend crumbled and started frantically texting me resources until I had to tell her to stop because it was stressing me out. Another friend gasped and drove through LA traffic to see me, only to tell me about other cancer stories she'd heard. This was also stressful. My mother was shocked, but promised, through her experience, that the illness could be expelled through battle and science. I was grateful for the support, but started to feel like I had to shield myself from others' reactions. I was still trying to sort out my nest of feelings. I knew the word cancer, but didn't yet know what it meant to me. I flew back to New York and spent the next 4 months in doctors' offices and hospitals. In several waiting rooms, I was surprised to see flyers for poetry writing workshops and reading groups offered alongside classes on nutrition and group therapy. Apparently, I wasn't the only one following the language of poems to help alchemize the language of cancer. I called Emily Rubin, who runs a writing workshop for cancer patients out of Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. I wanted to understand how these workshops, backlit by illness, might work. Writing and reading help us feel less alone, she said. You can have a conversation with a line of poetry as a way to have a conversation with yourself. Sleepless in my Brooklyn apartment after I learned I would need that hysterectomy, I read Poem to My Uterus by Lucille Clifton, where she talked about her own experience with the procedure. Uterus, my bloody print, my estrogen kitchen. Where am I going? Where am I going? I had that question, too. I was socked by the foreshadow of such a bodily loss. By witnessing her having a conversation with her body part, I began to have one with mine. Her language offered a way to look at my own womb from another angle when a direct stare felt too scary. I began to feel a little more compassion and softness toward my pelvis, rather than just anger and fear. Looking for more support in books, I read Audre Lorde's The Cancer Journals and poet Anne Boyer's The Undying. Pain doesn't destroy language, Boyer wrote. It changes it. I began to feel that shift happening in real time. Doctors' visits piled up, and I walked through days increasingly defined by hard-edged words like pathology report, hysteroscopy, and lymph node mapping. The vocabulary of illness could be flattening. In offices, I was a patient. Having cancer on my chart sometimes felt like a label. It elicited methodical, clinical approaches from nurses doing my blood work, or opened floods of feeling, people tipping their heads with worried eyes. I craved words that would give me space rather than close me in. I found them in the poetry of Andrea Gibson, who had recently passed from ovarian cancer. I whisper into my doctor's stethoscope so she can hear my heart. My heart, an heirloom. I didn't inherit until I thought I could die. Gibson's poems pushed back against reductive ideas of illness by giving voice to their own specific experiences. Their words were also not afraid to look at death. In doing so, they found so much joy in life. Wasn't it death that taught me how many beautiful things can be seen in a single second? Even though I'd caught my cancer early at stage one, it was impossible not to feel the edges of my own mortality. The shadow of it hit me at random moments, in the grocery store or on a walk. Gibson's work reminded me there was room in a poem, in both its language and white space, to hold how big illness and the brush of death could feel. And because Gibson had found their own distinctive words to explain what they'd felt, I began to consider how I could be more exact with my own. No two people were alike, so no two experiences of cancer were. What was mine? I turned a page. As an author and essayist, I was used to processing my world through language, but my experience of cancer didn't feel logical like a narrative, a story with a beginning, middle, and end. It felt chaotic and charged. It had been a while, maybe a decade, since I'd been in the practice of writing my own poems. Now I decided to turn back to it. I allowed myself to give way to imagery, rhythm, and illusion, and the very act of writing gave my mind something else to focus on, a relief. In such a serious time, I found play on the page. I played around with different definitions, my own, of the C word. Word of inescapable, word of rolling deep weight of ocean's core. Poems let us time travel, and I wrote back to Dickinson, imagining I could join her in the kind of bravery her couplet suggested. It's you and me, with our supernatural strength, our uteruses still, those sockets of light, honey-held portals, leading to no others but ourselves. Doctors shared that my prognosis was relatively positive. Because we'd caught it early, if my next surgery went according to plan, I wouldn't need chemo or further treatment. 9 months after my initial diagnosis, in deep winter, I was wheeled into another OR. I tried to stay calm, but seeing all the doctors in their scrubs, my body broke out into a cold sweat. Nausea hit me. I repeated the Dickinson syllables I'd carried since the start. If your nerve deny you, go above your nerve. I imagined leaping over. I made it through. After sitting with my mother and coming down from anesthesia, the cancer finally removed from my body, I knew two things. I had more healing ahead, and I suddenly had much more to say. Write this down, I told her, and she laughed, pulling out a notebook. It would take time to begin to unpack what this journey had given me. But for now, she helped me catch what I was saying, or what my body was. We gathered language as a celebration that we were still alive to voice it. The next article is called Three Simple Ways to Reset Your Focus. Biology and life conspire to make us sleep and distracted at work. Here's how to lock back in. This article was written by Michelle Ross and published April 23rd, 2026. Welcome to our new column, Start Somewhere, which breaks down complex topics like gut health, emotional well-being, and personal finance into three simple but impactful actions you can take today. We all have to start somewhere, right? So take that first step with us. Here it is again, like clockwork, the post-lunch crash. Your brain, which was firing on all cylinders at 10 a.m., now resembles a browser with 33 tabs open. You have so many things left on your to-do list, and yet you can't stop staring at a friend of a friend's vacation pics on Instagram. Turns out that scatterbrained feeling is a collision of biology and modern life. Most of us hit a predictable dip in alertness around 1 to 3 p.m., says Sanam Hafiz Saidi, a neuropsychologist and the founder and director of Comprehend the Mind, a psychology practice in New York City. Your body temperature naturally dips a bit in mid-afternoon, she says, signaling to your brain that it's time to rest, even though your employer likely lacks a siesta policy. On top of that, most of us are overstimulated, underslept, and eating lunches that spike and crash our blood sugar, which makes the whole thing significantly worse, she says. Plus, you're likely juggling way too much. Another reason we lose focus during the day is the fact that we're cognitively overloaded from all the work we've been doing, especially if it requires a lot of task switching across meetings, emails, and multiple streams of communication, says Tommy Wood, PhD, a neuroscientist and the author of The Stimulated Mind. At a certain point, your brain can't keep up, and it short circuits. But you don't need to move to Spain. Try these expert-vetted ways to lock back in for the rest of the day. Number 1, turn on the cold water. Hafiz says splashing some cold water on your face and wrists is one of the fastest ways to reset your nervous system and get some pep in your step. It slows your heart rate and sharpens alertness almost immediately, she says. No caffeine required, maybe just a quick makeup touch-up. Number 2. Pop some gum. Per Hafiz, chomping on a stick of gum can help you concentrate. Chewing increases blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain responsible for focus and decision-making, she says. Bonus points if it's peppermint-flavored, as the herb may increase blood flow to this same region of the brain. Just the aroma can enhance alertness, processing speed, and memory. Number 3. Drop the F-bomb. Feeling fuzzy? Wood suggests cursing like you mean it. Loud swearing has been shown to improve performance as well as mood and memory, compared to shouting neutral or nonsense four-letter words, he says. Why? He says it's likely due to increased arousal, psychology speak for feeling more energized and activated. It also doesn't hurt that a few strategic curses can cut the tension and make you laugh, lightening your mental load so you can get back to work. If you're worried about offending deskmates or HR, Hafiz suggests jotting down what's on your mind, your to-do list, worries, errands, etc. Your brain actively burns energy trying to hold on to all of it in the background, so getting it out of your head and onto paper essentially frees up working memory, she says. Think of it as closing a few tabs in your mental browser to deal with later. The next article is titled, No Offense to Protein, But Fiber is the Real Super Nutrient, Especially If You're in Menopause. Here's Why and How to Get Enough. This article was written by Christina Mannion, RDN, and published March 18, 2026. Yes, we get it. Protein is the it girl of wellness right now. But her bright star is outshining another critical nutrient that the majority of Americans desperately need more of in their diets. Fiber. Fiber is a type of carbohydrate that your body cannot digest, says Maggie Connolly, RDN, a dietitian and owner of Be Balanced Nutrition Services. She describes fiber as the skeleton of plants, since it provides structure as much as bones do for our bodies. Aside from helping plants stand tall, fiber supports many critical aspects of human health. And, according to the latest dietary guidelines for Americans, more than 90% of women do not consume enough of it. Whoops. Here's why the underrated, unsexy nutrient is so important, and how to eat more of it. Fiber's superpowers. Broadly speaking, fiber helps your body process waste efficiently, protects your cardiovascular and immune systems, supports healthy weight management, and staves off chronic diseases. If only it could do our taxes too. How does it do so much? Because there are actually two types of fiber found in plants, soluble and insoluble, and they work together like Batman and Robin in your body. Soluble fiber, found in foods like oat bran, apples, berries, lentils, and barley, dissolves in water to form a gel-like substance. This gel helps slow down digestion and aids in the absorption of nutrients, explains Connolly. Keeping things slow also stabilizes your energy level after eating, no post-lunch sleepies, and helps you feel fuller after meals, handy if you're trying to lose weight. It's also good for managing diarrhea and other irritable bowel syndrome symptoms. But that's not all. The gel created by soluble fiber sucks up bad stuff from your body on its way out of your gut, too. It binds to dietary cholesterol particles in the small intestine before they hit your bloodstream, lowering your cholesterol and reducing your risk of heart disease. Soluble fiber also binds to bile acids to help eliminate toxins from the body, says Connolly. Soluble fiber even acts as a prebiotic, or food for the healthy bacteria living in your gut microbiome. well-fed gut critters help support your immunity and brain health and are linked to a reduced risk of chronic disease. Seriously, what's not to love here? Insoluble fiber, found in foods like cauliflower, celery, skin-on potatoes, and whole grains, does not dissolve in water, hence the name. Instead, it passes through our digestive system mostly intact, acting like a broom, says Connolly, which is why it works wonders for constipation. Plus, soluble and insoluble fiber are associated with decreased colon cancer risk. How to get your fill. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans recommends eating 14 grams of fiber for every 1,000 calories you take in every day, but I generally recommend a higher intake for my clients, between 25 and 35 grams of fiber per day, to help with blood sugar control and weight management, says Connolly. For example, one medium apple has about 4 grams of fiber, and a serving of canned black beans packs in almost 7 grams. She adds that fiber can be extra helpful for her menopausal clients to help reduce digestive woes, common at this time of life, like gas, bloating, constipation, indigestion, and diarrhea. That fiber goal may seem daunting, particularly if you've been deep in protein-loading land. But there are so many tasty ways to up your fiber intake, since it's found in basically every fruit, veggie, whole grain, nut, and seed you can think of. You don't even need to worry about soluble versus insoluble intake, since most plant foods contain a mix of both. Just focus on eating a good variety of plant foods and leave the skin on foods like apples and potatoes for the most benefit. Ironically, going from 0 to 60 on your fiber intake overnight can make for a very unhappy gut. Cramping, constipation, gas, oh my! To ease the way, go slowly, increasing around 5 grams of fiber per day until you've met your target, says Connolly. That translates to around one additional daily serving of a fiber-packed food. Drinking enough water, at least 64 fluid ounces of water per day, can also move the additional roughage through your GI tract smoothly. While there are lots of convenient packaged items packed with fiber, proceed with caution before adding them to your cart. When people choose fiber-enhanced foods like low-carb wraps, bars, gummies, and prebiotic-rich drinks, they may feel discomfort, says Connolly. Again, having a lot of fiber at once can seriously backfire. However, a minimally processed option, like a psyllium husk supplement, can be helpful if you're struggling to eat enough plant-based foods. At the end of the day, getting enough fiber basically entails eating your fill of fruits and vegetables. Add this to the long, long list of reasons why eating the rainbow is aces for your health. Article this episode is called "Want to Fall Asleep Faster? Try Gaslighting Your Brain." Psychologists explain why telling yourself to stay awake can have the opposite effect. This article was written by Aaron Bunch and published April 29, 2026. If you've ever lain in bed, desperately willing yourself to sleep, me on most nights, you're familiar with a cruel irony. The harder you try to force sleep, the more awake you feel. When you can't drift off, panic sets in and your insomnia feels like a high-stakes problem that needs solving ASAP. After all, sleep supports our metabolism, immunity, and mental well-being, while offering our bodies much-needed time to repair and reset. But the more you try to make it happen, the harder it is to achieve. That's because sleep is a biological process that collapses under pressure, says Shelby Harris, PsyD, a clinical psychologist, sleep specialist, and the author of The Women's Guide to Overcoming Insomnia. Fortunately, there may be a simple solution to this type of sleeplessness. It's called paradoxical intention, or pretending you want to stay awake, even when you definitely don't. We asked sleep experts about the surprising science behind paradoxical intention and how you can try it at home. When trying to sleep backfires. Under normal circumstances, your body builds sleep drive, your natural need for sleep, throughout the day simply by being awake and active, says Colleen Carney, PhD, a professor and director of the Sleep and Depression Laboratory at Toronto Metropolitan University. By the time you get into bed, you should have accumulated enough to drift off easily. But when you lie there willing yourself to conk out because you're worried about being well rested for tomorrow's presentation, or you want to make up for a bad night earlier in the week, That mental effort creates arousal that overrides your sleep drive. Suddenly, you're wide awake and exhausted. Over time, this issue can create a cycle of sleeplessness. The more you try to make sleep happen, the more anxious you get and the harder it is to attain, says Eric Prather, PhD, a sleep scientist at the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of The Sleep Prescription. And the more bad nights you have, the more stressed you get about sleeping, which only amplifies your issues. Many people then try to double down on their sleep efforts, reaching for an eye mask, downloading a white noise app, or going to bed an hour earlier, says Carney. But each of those fixes reinforces the idea that there's something wrong with you, which only worsens your stress about getting a good night's rest. Trying to sleep is like trying to fall in love. It's not going to work, she says. Sleep has to unfold naturally. The simple magic of paradoxical intention. Essentially, paradoxical intention is treating your brain like a petulant child. Ask it to do something, and it will do the opposite. In this case, instead of fixating on falling asleep, you lie quietly in bed with your eyes open and try to stay awake, without turning on lights, reaching for your phone, or otherwise engaging your brain. Shifting your mental effort away from sleep in this way can reduce arousal and allow your natural sleep drive to take over, says Carney. One of the fears in insomnia is that you'll lie awake all night long, and paradoxical intention directly faces that fear, adds Carney. When you're actively trying to stay awake, you no longer brace for the thing you dread, insomnia, and this reduces the sense of threat around sleep. Threat averted, your brain can relax and conk out. This may sound like a TikTok hack, but paradoxical intention is a legitimate technique developed by renowned psychiatrist and neurologist Viktor Frankl to treat anxiety and phobias. It was later adapted for insomnia in the 1970s by psychologist L. Michael Asher, says Carney, and there is some evidence to support its efficacy. In professional settings, paradoxical intention isn't widely used as a standalone treatment, Carney says, but it may be included as part of a more comprehensive cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, a structured, evidence-based approach that addresses the thoughts and behaviors that interfere with sleep. CBTI is the treatment of choice for chronic insomnia, says Carney. Paradoxical intention tends to work best for people with sleep-onset insomnia, those who struggle to fall asleep at the start of the night, rather than people who wake in the middle of it, says Carney. It's especially useful when anxiety about sleeping is part of the problem, adds Prather, not just difficulty sleeping, but stress and worry about that difficulty. This technique may be less effective for other sleep struggles, says Prather. For example, if you fall into rumination, repetitive, intrusive thoughts that are hard to shut off, lying awake can sometimes give those thoughts more room to spiral. In those cases, strategies that gently redirect your attention, like listening to something calming or reading, might be more helpful. If you want to try paradoxical intention, remember that repetition matters. With practice, Carney says, you can potentially learn to trust your body to do what it already knows how to do. As Prather says, if people can just get out of their own way, sleep will happen. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Allie Irving, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are.